It's time for Mac Break Weekly. We talk about the latest Mac rumors, including Apple TV. Could it be an actual big screen? All coming up with Darren Okada, who is a cinematographer, so he knows about these kinds of things. Andy Iannacco and me. Mac Break Weekly is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 298, recorded May 8th, 2012. FDR and the coffee mug. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. Automatic, continuous, unlimited backup for your computer files, only $59 a year. Try it free at Carbonite.com and use the offer code MACBREAK to get 2 bonus months with purchase. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code MACBREAK5. And don't forget, they now offer free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. And by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker who needs stock video clips, photos, illustrations, music tracks, or sound effects, check out Pond5 for instant downloads at the best prices anywhere. Pond5.com. And for 25% off this month, use the offer code TWIT25. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show that covers your latest Macintosh needs in great detail, great obsessive depth. Joining us, Darren Okada, who is a cinematographer. And are you still president of the SoCal ASC?
Past president. The ASC.
Of the Association. American Society
of Cinematographers.
There we go. We got it. You see it in every movie. You know, you see Douglas Trumbull, ASC. You see every movie.
It's an honorary society. It's the oldest one in Hollywood. Started in 1919. And it's made up of the best cinematographers in the world.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you. We have Darren on every time we do CES or NAB. But to have you in studio is wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great coming up here. I'm in the brick house.
You're in the brick house,
I wanted to see it. Now I'm in the brick house.
Yeah. And now we had your buddy, Alex Lindsay, but his connection from the Motel Marriott in Burbank.
Yeah.
What a surprise. Wasn't so good. So he's dead. And that's fine because we've got you and we've got the lovely Andy Iannacco, who is apparently coming to us from the Boston Public Library today.
No. This is the long room at the old library, Trinity College.
Trinity College. Ooh.
Yes. In Dublin.
He's coming to us from Dublin, from Ireland.
Also, as ripped off by George Lucas for the Jedi Library in Star Wars Episode 2.
Yeah, that's why it looks familiar. Mm. No planet Hoth in that episode, though.
No, it could have used some Hoth.
I visited Hoth over the past week. Thank you, Andy, for filling in. For me. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure to give you a week off.
You do too well.
You have so few of them.
Every time you're on, I get tweets saying, you know, you should just get off that show and let Andy take it. Did you dance on the table at some point?
No, I had people dancing for me. It's
okay. Just checking. Wow. Wow. All right. Well, there's some Apple news, just a little bit in the works today. I'm going to start with probably the big security story. Of a flaw in OS X Lion that's been around for, oh my God, 3 months and counting. It allows anyone, well, there's several. Apparently, they keep the passwords in plain text on OS X Lion. So now the good news is you have to have physical access to somebody's computer. But if you do, even if you're not an administrator, you can use a simple terminal command that will change anybody's password.
Have you tried that?
Yeah.
To see if it works?
Let's see. You want to try it? Should we do it?
Yeah. Let's see how vulnerable it really is. I was actually going to do it when you were looking the other way.
You get an error. Yeah, I know. You get an error message. What you do is you go into the terminal and you type this. Now, it appears to give an error, apparently. So let's just try it, terminal. Now, actually, I have to see who else I have because obviously I can change my own password. So that's not going to really
That's not. Let me see who else I have on this machine.
Do you want me to show this or?
Yeah, why not?
All right.
They all want to see his password.
They all want to see my password. Okay, let me see
why
who else is on this machine.
We're all compromised anyway. I only have me.
But see, what you do is you do this DSCL localhost dash password, and then you just put in a plug in a user. And it says, what's the new password?
Oh, and just, wow. That's too fast.
Now, I am the admin, so I should really do this. I should create a limited account and try to change the admin password, but I don't want to take the time to do that. But let's take it as given, since this seems to be the story everywhere. Mm-hmm. Once the admin's password is changed, of course, the hacker could then log in to the admin account and have full access to the system. But the key is on this. That you need to have physical access to the hardware.
So if you're like at Starbucks, don't walk away from your computer too long.
Right. And if you have a prankster brother or co-host, do not, you know, log out.
Yeah, that's why it's always three kinds of scary whenever I'm at the Panera at the Starbucks and I see somebody just walk away from their $1,500 laptop to get a refill or to take the pause that refreshes, because they think that the people in the room are not going to simply going to grab it and run. But, oh, man, I can do nothing but think about the 9 different things you can do to a computer to do lots of damage if you just have about 2 minutes worth of hands-on access to it that are just bad, 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 super bad.
Well, Leo did that, and it was like 30 seconds. Bang.
Bang. But not even that long. Just as long as you've got the command memorized.
Yeah. And it's also a warning about having guest account access because a lot of people keep a guest account up there. Because they might have to share a computer, but they want to make sure that people don't have access to other parts of the machine. Some people also use guest accounts as a honey trap,
right?
So that if they have tracking softwares installed, it will sort of inspire the thief or the person who buys it not to reformat the hard drive just yet, and you know, use it just long enough for the tracking software to get a fix and get a couple pictures. But this really does show the vulnerability of having anybody having any sort of access to your machine hands on.
So you don't even want. You don't want a guest account because you just don't want anybody on your system, period.
Well, so here's what from CNET, from Topher Kessler writing in CNET's Mac Fix It column. Here's what he suggests. First of all, disable automatic login. Now, that's, of course, a terrible security risk. It means when you boot your computer, it just logs in.
That's,
of course,
that's like leaving your car unlocked.
Right. I have it set up that way just because I'm lazy, but I guess I'll turn that off. Enable sleep and screensaver passwords. Of course, if you walk away and the screensaver goes in, kicks in, you might even want to turn down the screensaver time. They will have to enter a password then to get to the terminal. And they need to get to the terminal in order to do this or be able to get to the directory where the passwords are stored. Disable guest accounts. That's what we were talking about. Because you can do this from a guest account. Mm-hmm. So even if you have guest accounts turned on and even if they can log in as a guest, they can do it. And then it says, manage users in the system. In other words, don't let other people be admins. You can disable access to the terminal for all accounts except admin accounts, for instance. That might be the solution to this. Using the limit applications in the parental controls. That seems like a lot of work. Apple will, I'm sure, patch this, but it isn't patched now. And the reason I wanted to lead with it, mostly because I want to go, ha, ha, no, because I led with it because I think everybody should know about it. It's a fairly security, serious security flaw, and it has been around for some time.
And realize that physical access is the one thing you really can't do much just to stop things about. If people can get the hands on your machine, pretty much it's security game over. It's terrible that they can actually create a new get access to your admin accounts and actually create their own admins accounts during whatever time they have access
amazing.
To it. But it also reminds you that lockdown access to your machine is a really, really big priority. Also, it's as good as time as any to remind people that if you haven't set an open firmware password on your Mac yet, it's probably a really good idea to do so. Because if someone does have that physical access to your machine, if they have enough time, they can just simply reboot it into target disk mode and they'll have full access to the actual volume just by mounting it as an external hard drive. And they'll also have the ability to reformat it, do all kinds of stuff to it if it gets stolen. Whereas if you use the open firmware, you utility. You get that by booting into recovery mode. It's one of the utilities that Apple that you'll boot into if that's available to you in Lion. You will be able to set an open firmware password so that none of the startup keys will work or be able to do anything really damaging unless you have that open firmware password plugged in. So it's a little extra layer of security. But once again, try to make sure that you do not leave your machine unattended for any amount of time without some sort of password locking it down.
Yeah. So that's a good point about the open firmware password. They should have included that. So according to Chris Forsman writing in Infinite Loop on Ars Technica, this bug was posted in February by a German sysadmin. He put it on the Apple support forums. No one responded until this weekend. And then a cryptography mailing list on Friday circulated the story. Paul Hazelden, a system administrator working in an education environment, claims in a post on Novell support forums that betas of the next OS 10 do not exhibit the problem, which is kind of interesting. Flaw is also not present in 10.7.2, so it's only 10.7.3, oddly enough.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Andy.
Oh, no, I was going to say, you're talking about the second bug that's related to File Vault?
This is a separate vault. I'm sorry. I thought this was the same one. This is a different one.
No, this is a different one. And this one is.
Oh, this allows you to decrypt File Vault. Oh, great.
The problem is that apparently there was some sort of like internal debugging system that had not been turned off or removed by the time 7.3 shipped. And so there is actually a file that, if you know where to look for it, your password is actually being logged and recorded in plain text. Now, this was not supposed to. Obviously, this is not something that was supposed to ever leave the debugging suite, but apparently it did.
I apologize. So that's two different bugs, and I conflated the two, and I apologize. Yep. So this is the home dir mounter, the fact that it keeps a log in plain text, which would get you the password, but it's a different way of doing it, I guess, and it lets you decrypt File Vault.
And the good news is that it will also has your login password, so it will not work. Yeah, it's a pretty big one, but it's not like that. It's not like the first one, in which it really affects every single user and every single Mac that's running this OS. This really only affects users of File Vault under certain conditions.
And 10.7.3, right.
Exactly, and that's the sort of thing that's going to be quickly closed up, I think.
File Vault 2. What's the difference between File Vault and File Vault 2? That's a full disk encryption.
Right, instead of just your user direct.
So if you use File Vault 2, this does not impact it. In fact, this would fix both problems, I think, if you used File Vault 2. You used the full disk encryption. Now, I turned on File Vault once, and it seemed really felt like it's, even on an SSD on a fast machine, it felt like it slowed things down. Was that just my imagining?
I felt that when I did that. Same thing happened to me. So I thought it was just overloading the processor, making it, you know, encrypt and decrypt.
Yeah.
So I actually have turned it.
Maybe File Vault 2 will not. Andy, do you have any experience with either?
Yeah, I mean, I had the exact same experience. That's why I didn't use it when it first came out. File Vault 2, which I have on my testbed machine, the sacrificial lamb, the canary in the cave. File Vault 2 is a lot faster. It's still, you still get a little bit of a performance hit, but you're going to get that anyway. But it's not as bad as File Vault one. It's possible to forget how fast your machine could possibly be if you were to try to. I mean, look at what it's doing. You're saying that every time it accesses the hard drive, and that means that every time it's paging stuff to memory, it is essentially doing a whole bunch of really complicated math. So
you can use File Vault 2 on if you have OS 10 Lion, presuming that the Recovery HD was installed in the startup drive, which it normally is when you run the OS 10 Lion installer. So you go into the Security and Privacy Preference pane and System Preferences, click the File Vault tab, and then I guess it will give you the option for the other one. I'm not sure how that works.
Yeah, I've never seen an option yet.
So I'm sorry. Apologize to everybody for working through this on the air here. Security and Privacy and File Vault. And I guess I guess you have to do something else for File Vault 2. It also, I'm told by Beatmaster in our chat room, because it needs a case-sensitive file format, disk format, some apps and games, older apps and games, may not like it. So I'm going to authenticate. Don't show that. And turn on File Vault. It gives you the key, which I don't want to show that. Anyway. File Vault 2 is all you can create. I get it. So just File Vault is File Vault 2 if you're using Lion.
Just like the new iPad.
Right. It's just File Vault.
It's just File Vault.
The second of the two. All right. Anyway, I thought we'd talk about that because that is fairly important breaking news. Two different security flaws, both of which require physical access, at least for now.
I mean, we've been so complacent just feeling that our systems are not vulnerable to anything.
Yeah.
Because we just, have been sort of the minority of the computer users. But now it's, you can't just assume that everything's safe. Everybody's after us now, it looks like.
But also kind of bears mentioning that Apple doesn't have a really great record. I really wish they would respond to these sort of problems differently. There's so many different reasons why they can't just necessarily, someone emails them with a problem, they get an email back an hour later saying, yes, we verified it, and gosh, this is a problem. And then 3 hours later, there's an update that's been patched.
Right.
That's not possible. But I wish there were a greater layer of transparency. The fact that someone can report a problem like this and not even get a response or claim to never receive a response from Apple saying that at least we thank you for your report. We do take security problems seriously. We're going to take a look at it. We may or may not be able to tell you what we're doing, but we're at least going to take a look at it. You at least need to know that your email went to the right place, and at least you set up a flare. If people ignore it, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but at least you set up a flare and someone saw it.
Yeah.
Do you think it might be Apple not wanting to show that there is any weaknesses?
Padre SJ in our chat room says it's just not in Apple's DNA to acknowledge problems of any kind. Look how hard it was for them to acknowledge antenna issues. It took some real cage rattling. I think that comes from Steve. I think that that's just kind of in their. Do you think in their DNA?
Well,
there are no problems.
That's one possibility, but when you're talking about security vulnerabilities in an operating system, there are competing philosophies on right. what the best thing to do is. I think it's absolutely true that the quicker you get the word out, the lesser the vulnerability is, even if it takes a while for the patch to be released. I think that in principle, you should always make sure your users are very aware of what's affecting their own machines. At the same time, you worry about the problem of you're worried enough about bad guys, like really active bad guys who are writing malware or just trying to break into individual targets' computers, having access to those kind of bugs. But what you really, really worry about is just idiots, jerks in your office who are not, Matthew Broderick grade hackers. They're just, hey, look what I found on this message board. Hey, look, I'm in Doug's computer. Hey, everybody. And then it becomes a problem that's actually probably a thousandfold. I kind of think about the problems with the guys in the Treasury Department had, where it's bad enough when you have organized crime who's trying to counterfeit bills and putting all this money into this counterfeiting operation and doing it in a sophisticated way and in a targeted way. But then when everybody got a color photocopier and now you got to deal with millions and millions of just people saying, hey, look, I made a $20 bill. Let's see if I can spend it. Now they're dealing with all of these. Ugh. So I do think Apple should at least be a little bit more open about how they deal with these sort of things. But I appreciate that there are different philosophies on what the best way to.
No, I think you're right, and other companies do the same thing. It's that security via obscurity versus being open. And in general, I think that there's kind of agreement in the security community that what you do when you find a flaw like this is you tell the appropriate people and you give them a reasonable amount of time to respond. Usually give them with a patch, right? And then after a certain amount of time, no response, then you might want to start publicizing it, especially if you see that hackers now know about it and it kind of has gotten around the community and people are doing something, then you might want to light the fire. I can remember this happening with Microsoft years ago. We had Matt Conover on, who was a hacker with WooWoo, and they had found a bug in Windows that was, I think they gave Microsoft almost a year to respond. They never did. They never fixed it, and people were starting to use it. So at that point, WooWoo says, well, we have to publicize. It was very controversial. I remember this was more than 10 years ago. We have to publicize it because the world knows about it, and it's not Microsoft's not doing anything. So there is you're right, there's this balance.
It becomes kind of complicated, especially now that there are all these white hat conferences in which there are prizes for or prone to own. You have security experts who will find a vulnerability, but they're going to sit on it for 6 months because they know that they can make $5,000 in the first 10 minutes of the con if they wait for
it. Dan Kaminsky does that. He admits it. Yeah. He sits on it. He waits. I got it. I'm going to hold on. Shh, don't tell anybody.
You know, if Apple, I don't think it hurts them to notify their, you know, their customers if there's any kind of a security thing. I mean, to me, it's, I feel more confident that they're looking out after us because, you know, there's that trust situation. And I think in this case, when there's that smokescreen of not being vulnerable, I think it you know, as these kind of stories break,
right,
it's going to start eroding at some of the confidence we all have with
it. Well, it might even be bad for them to admit it, but there's kind of an obligation.
Yeah.
There's a moral obligation to acknowledge and fix a flaw that could cause a problem, not just for an individual user, but for the internet as a whole. I just think there is an obligation to do that. I think the other point, the point Dan Kaminsky probably would make, is that all there's holes everywhere. Everything. It's all. There was a, I tweeted this. There's a Wired magazine article that says, everyone's been hacked. Now what? The premise basically, look, you know, every software, every program ever written has flaws in it. Everybody is vulnerable. They start talking about how Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where they make nukes, was hacked last year. And they said, basically the premise is nothing you can do. So the real thing is what come up with some good security policies that do the best they can to protect us long term. There's a picture of Dan Kaminsky in this article, by the way.
I wonder what he's looking at.
What you looking at, Dan? He says he's glad the security bubble has finally burst and people are realizing no network is immune from attack. That means, he says, and by the way, to network I would add operating system. That means, he says, the security industry and its customers can finally face the uncomfortable fact that for what they've been doing for years isn't working. The premise of this article is everybody kind of does the same voodoo, which doesn't work, and says, well, we did what everybody says you do, so that's all we're going to do. So I think that we're in a new age, and maybe Apple needs to think about these things. I don't think physical attack problem, holes are as nearly as big a problem as stuff that can come in over the internet.
Yeah.
Because somebody has to get your machine. So just don't let anybody get your machine. We're going to take a break, come back with more. We're talking tech right now. Andy Iannocco is here from the Chicago Sun-Times. And the website Celestial Waste of Bandwidth, Darren Okada from the ASC.com, cinematographer. I should ask you. Well, we'll come back and we'll ask you if there's anything cool and exciting.
Yeah.
We saw a really cool camera at several really cool cameras at NAB, and I'm just wondering, when is that Black Magic camera going to be at? But first, a word about Carbonite online backup. When you're talking about security, one of the important things that maybe we forget is that it's not merely locking down your system, it's making sure you have copies of your data in a safe and secure place so that you can get it back. And that's what Carbonite is all about. Online, unlimited, continuous backup for those files, those irreplaceable files that you just can't afford to lose. And it's as little as $59 a year per computer. That's a great deal. But here's an even better deal. Try it for free for 2 weeks. Just go to Carbonite, CARBONITE.com. Of course it works on a Mac. They've got a Mac on their front page. That's how you know it works on a Mac. Carbonite.com. Use the offer code MACBREAK. And you've got 2 weeks free. You don't even need a credit card. See? That's a Mac. It's kind of an old Mac.
It's an old Mac.
It's titanium, I think, right?
It's very compatible. It's great. Backwards compatibility. I love it.
Stock photo. They probably got it on Pine 5, right? Carbonite.com, offer code MacBreak. And then if you decide to buy, and I know you will, I use it on all my machines, you're gonna want to use MacBreak again because that'll give you 14 months for the price of 12, two free months with purchase of a year subscription. Carbonite.com. It's backup done right. Well, I'm going to move on to something cheerier. Let's cheerier, happier. Something positive. After postmortem, NAB, you've had a few weeks to get over it.
Yeah.
We were there, of course, Darren was there. Canon showed those great cinematographer cameras.
Right.
$15,000 to $30,000. And then Blackmagic, I think, steals their thunder with the Blackmagic cinema camera for $2,500.
Steals their thunder, but
it's not a 4K camera, I understand.
It's not a 4K camera. It's a great camera for being purpose-built. because it's a box.
It's just a sensor.
Yeah, it's a sensor. It's a box. If you're going to mount it on a tripod, that's cool. And at the price point, it's great.
Why do you say mount it on a tripod? Is that rolling shutter, jelly roll?
No, it's just that the shape of the camera. It's like
it's kind of funky.
It's like a fat, right. a big iPad here.
You know why I like it? Because it uses my existing lenses. Yeah. Like my Nikon or Canon lenses.
Well, you can get mounts for a lot of different cameras, but
so it's not a threat to Red or a Canon.
No, it's in a different price range. Right. It's
it's more for people, normal people.
Yeah. I actually last night. I mean, NAB had a lot of things, and sort of the shakeout from it now is when there are people rolling things out.
Right.
There's with the high end cameras, the 4K cameras. The workflow issues are being worked out yet.
I thought that was really interesting. A lot of what we saw at NAB was not about hardware. It was about how do you solve the problems that are created by these giant video files.
Exactly.
What do you do with them?
And the files, when they come out, if you're talking like Red RAW files or Canon, all these 4K cameras have to be debayered or demosaic. They take the pattern because of the bandwidth that comes off the chip. Comes off so fast, 24 frames a second, that it doesn't combine all of the color pixels you need to create a picture. It's like a raw photo that you would do in your still camera.
You can get all the information is there. You can get
it's
it back.
There. But where the files blow up is debayering it.
And then you got too much information.
Yeah, now you have a composite image there.
Oy.
But to do that workflow is what they're all working through now because you need to do it as fast as you can.
So we have 4K projectors in theaters. I think the question then is when do we get 4K projectors at home or 4K?
I think that's going to be pretty close.
I think we're just a year or two off, right?
Yeah, I think next CES you're going to see 4K in the home.
So according to Cult of Mac, Leander Connie writing, our source, who they unnamed source, has seen the Apple TV. It's real, and here's what it looks like.
Now, I think that was speculative, I think.
Well, it doesn't look like that picture. No, that's.
I think this picture.
You're watching video and you're seeing a picture of Robert Redford, not that. We have a source, says Leander, who has seen a prototype, claims to have seen a prototype, Apple high definition television set in action. Of course, now I think we've heard from many people that we've seen these for years in action, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's meaningful. According to the source, who was asked to remain strictly anonymous, the Apple HDTV looks like an Apple LED backlit cinema display, but is, quote, much bigger.
So it's almost like an iMac.
I don't know. Is it 27? Is it 52? Is it 134? I don't know.
I think if they're going to enter the television market, they've got to start at 32 to 40.
Nobody's going to buy a TV that's less than that, for sure.
Yeah. But this,
I think the standard is now really 50, right? 47 or 50.
Yeah. Anybody who's making an investment in television is getting a 42-inch or 50-inch, if not bigger.
I set up my projector last night, and I projected on the wall with my 55-inch, and it makes the 55 look this big. Yeah. And you really, what happens is your expectations just scale, right? And so pretty soon, I mean, we're talking about a 42-inch TV. 10 years ago, that's huge.
Yeah.
Now it's like, well, that's not so big.
Huge in price. It was like $10,000.
According to Leander, built-in EyeSight camera for making free FaceTime video conference calls. Now, this is interesting. It has Siri, according to this guy.
Fine Twit TV.
And it, of course, supports AirPlay. Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? Watch Twit. Hey, Siri. Mm.
See, Siri is the thing that always comes up when we speculate about an Apple TV. And man, even just today, I was using iPad voice recognition to respond to an email, and I don't want. I hate a remote control on a TV where the button is a little bit soft, and I have to push it 3 or 4 times to make it do what I want. The second time I have to say, "The Rifle Man."
Yeah, I hate that.
Siri. Find I'm in the mood for Chuck Connors.
That Rifle Man.
Honey, I didn't mean to put that movie on. I was watching The Simpsons.
I said The Rifle Man.
But this photo that's on here, I guess, is just a mock-up of what it could look like. What are the advantages of it being all in one? Unless the picture quality is going to be something that they deem as OLED,
I led into this with the 4K thing. I mean, I think if Apple maybe made a really high-res display, I don't know. And the other thing is, this could have been something which just cobbled together a cinema display, an right. Apple TV, Siri. It's not clear, although according to this story, it's something they want to release. Our source is well-placed and has provided us with great tips in the past. However, not all of them have panned out due to the fact our source tends to see products in the prototype or early development stage.
Oh, and it says they're speculating that it's nothing exotic like OLED or 4K,
huh.
Which means it'll be OLED and 4K.
You're right. They're going for the double bluff. Right.
Exactly.
They discovered a brand new color that only this monitor will be able to reproduce. So if you want to see deep, naturalistic, fairly purple. Saturated blurb, you're going to have to go to Apple.
Well, you know, I just thought an interesting point here is that with the iPad being more resolution than HDTV, I would think that for Apple to make a really cool product, it would be more than resolution, more than HDTV. I mean, it's a tough.
Why not?
Yeah, you know, why not go that?
And then offer on iTunes, you know.
Yeah.
1280 by 1090.
And you could, yeah, exactly.
Well, not just that, but for the gaming experience, certainly.
Yes.
Right. For the photo experience, to simply say that we can show you photos that are even better than what you can get at Best Buy. And it only costs an extra, you know, what, $900, $1,000?
You know, this
but
is.
But here's another area which I always have to preface this by saying I'm not skeptical. It's just that I can't imagine what Apple sees as a priority and what Apple thinks they can sell. The difficulty is that an HDTV, even just a 1080 HDTV, has to be pretty big before it becomes a retina. The advantages become truly retina grade, where you have to be sitting at the apex, that holy triangle, that certain distance from the screen before you can really tell the difference between 1080 and even 720. So it's just another question mark that I've added to a big bag full of question marks. If Apple were to do a greater than 1080 resolution screen, could they do it in such a way that someone sitting on a sofa would actually appreciate the difference between that and 1080?
Well, you know, Andy, this is actually the evil plan. Looks like it's actually materializing. That what a great way to get people to only use iTunes,
right,
as your source to rent movies, because it's 2048 beyond right. HD, and you can play it on the new Apple TV.
What if?
My confusion is that Apple always makes a big deal about how the every time they use the term retina, it's about the minimum resolving right. resolution of the human eye. And then what if at the press conference, the first question asked is, yeah, but according to your own math, nobody's going to be able to, the human eye cannot tell the difference between your $2,000 TV and a $1,200 TV made by Sony. Because unfortunately, there are no Jaguars in the audience of my living room. It's human eyes that we're dealing with here. So why would they create a screen that's higher resolution than the human eye could really make out?
Because they can sell the movies themselves.
No. I have to say I am still highly skeptical about this. I just don't buy it. And I just don't see them doing this.
I'm not skeptical. I mean, there's so many signs right now that such a thing is being worked on.
Whether I know we keep hearing this.
This year, next year, or never. My disconnect is that there's so many other Apple products where I really do have strong opinions that if I've been paying attention, if the conclusions that I've drawn about Apple and what they feel their messages make sense, then I don't believe that this product will have that feature or that product that would be of any interest to Apple at all. When it comes to an Apple branded TV, I just don't know. I mean, this could be like an Apple branded camera, where I feel as
also
though
a bad
why,
idea.
Yeah. Exactly. Why would Apple get into that market? I have to dismiss that out of hand. Or is it more like the iPad, where it's like, I understand the concept of a tablet. I can understand the concept of why Apple would want to get into that market, but I don't feel as though I can predict exactly how Apple would build a tablet and what that would look like. And I'm sure that would make a lot, it would make perfect sense when they make it, that this is why Apple felt as though they could really disrupt the existing market with their own attitude, right, and their own idea for a TV set.
Yeah, we have to, I mean, that's always the standard disclaimer. I didn't think they'd make a phone, you know, who would want to get in the cell phone business? And Apple, in fact, turns out didn't want to get in the cell phone business. They wanted to make their own, but they just couldn't. Who would want to, right, what would be cool about a tablet? How could they possibly, succeed in a sector that Microsoft failed in for 10 years? So, yes, you're right. We acknowledge that, at least I acknowledge, I have no idea
what they're doing. I am but an imperfect vessel for the universe's perfection.
Yes. Yes.
As long as we're talking rumors, I think this is interesting. A $799 MacBook Air, kind of a response to the low-priced Ultrabooks, although I have to say the best Ultrabooks are the same price basically as an Air. They start at $1,000.
That's like saying that like the Avengers movie is Marvel's answer to the Green Lantern movie. You know, I really don't think that Apple is very intimidated by the success of the Ultrabook concept at this point, and that they would do anything to really respond to it, unless they found themselves in a position where they could produce a substantially different version of the 11-inch Air. That is so good that at $999, it's still a really impressive device, and that they could take the existing MacBook Air and do what they did with the iPad 2, simply say, okay, we're going to knock $150 off the price. And so now there's going to be an $850 MacBook Air for 11-inch model that has a two-year-old processor in it, but still very, very good and very, very capable of running iLife, iWork, and accessing iCloud. But if you want the really cool Sandy Bridge processor for the exact same price, we'll give you a larger storage, we'll give you three Thunderbolt ports, because that's how strongly we feel about this new standard, and keep that as the price at $999. But otherwise, I don't feel as though they're feeling any pressure from.
The only case I would make for a $799 Air, and it's the only case, and it's a very limited case, is that they no longer have an inexpensive education product. They dumped the polycarbonate white MacBook. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm aware of this is the school. I'm on the board of my kid's high school, and they have a what they call a one-to-one program. When you come in as a freshman, you get a laptop and you keep it for all 4 years. And it has been the white MacBook. And I said, well, why don't you, they killed the white MacBook. I said, why don't you go to the MacBook Air? And they said, well, it's, even that few hundred dollars more is too much. We can't afford
multiplied
it.
Multiplied by all the students.
Yeah, it's a lot of students. So they're actually, I hate to say this, but I think they're going to go to a Windows machine. Which Sad. Just kills me. In fact, if I can talk them out of it, I will. But they just cannot afford buy a Mac. And so that would be the one argument for a low-cost something is the education market.
I sincerely think that Apple, when people make that complaint to them, Apple's answer is, well, we have this wonderful $399 computer called the iPad that is even better for education than maybe even more appropriate than a Windows notebook and even more appropriate than a Mac.
I've advised them not to get it. I agree, and I think the iPad, especially the new one, is a lot closer than ever, but I just don't see a student writing a paper on an iPad.
Oh, you need a keyboard.
Yeah, but then that's a kind of solution.
Yeah, no, then you're pretty much making a MacBook Air.
Well, cheap Air. Still cheap,
well,
right?
Yeah, $399 plus $69 for an Apple wireless keyboard. That's still under $500 and still a wonderful thing. Or you can.
I think there's still concerns about durability. Mm-hmm. And I think there, because I mean, I don't think an iPad is particularly robust. And I think there's also a concern about how people work. I mean, I find it hard to do research and write a paper on a screen that doesn't have Windows.
Yeah, I agree.
Windowing,
with you.
Yeah, windowing, lowercase Windows.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think there are advantages to either one of them. The devil's advocate position is that a Windows notebook or even a MacBook isn't a really good book reader. It really isn't great for advanced kinds of courseware, and the battery life is such that you really do have to keep the students tethered towards power most of the time. But speaking with the full authority as somebody who has only one dependent, and that's a stuffed toy Dalmatian dog, as opposed to the two or three kids grades K through 12. But I do keep a close ear to what my friends with kids are up to. And yeah, I mean, that's a story that's played out in every single school system.
It's tricky.
More of them are seeing the credibility of an iPad. Because of the cost benefit, because of the fact that it's a very, very low maintenance sort of thing. And there are very few things that a kid can do outside of dropping it to screw up an iPad. We're not just talking about dropping it. We're talking about oh, God, well, why is this kid downloading this? Why did
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for that.
Why are they visiting this site and downloading this sort of malware? Right. But it's a spread spectrum problem.
Yeah. No, there's a lot to be said for that. However, for whatever reason, this school, I think, is going to get a $500 Lenovo education
model
that they're going to go for. And I think that they looked at the iPad and they really, and I think quite rightly, I think that, look, when it's education, you want to experiment with kids' future, right?
Yeah.
So, and when you buy an iPad as a incoming freshman, you're kind of making a commitment. And, for four years.
So. And the other thing is that you have to think about support and infrastructure, where if you need to hire or subcontract a group that's going to keep 500 copies of this device running and all the software running at the same time, the pool of candidates for that job on Windows is vastly greater than the pool of candidates who can do that job on an iPad. So it's a lot of variables.
I think also, now let me ask you, but it seems to me that if you give kids an iPad, the assumption is they have a computer still at home, right?
Would that
there be their only computer?
Well, they would need Wi-Fi access at home, so you would assume there'd be another computer at home.
Right. I don't know. I'd like to experiment, but not with my kids.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Apple feels
experiment on your kids, but not with your
kids. You know what's interesting? Neither Abby nor Henry, and I've offered both of them iPads, has any interest. They don't want iPads. They both have laptops. Abby has an Air, and she has a 13-inch MacBook Pro, and he has a 13-inch white MacBook, and neither one has an interest in an Air for whatever iPad. Reason.
I wonder if that's going to change in the next couple of years, because I talked about this last week. I spent my week in Ireland. The only computer I brought was an iPad and a keyboard, and it worked just fine, even though I was doing a lot more than just emailing people and Twittering pictures from the day. So as we get more muscular apps and as more of that infrastructure gets built out, we might see those decisions going the other way next year.
Yeah, it's really interesting and challenging. And I guess the sad thing is that Apple's education computer now is $1,000 instead of $800, and that's a significant difference from the point of view of a school who's buying hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. That would be my only argument for a cheap $799 Air.
That's a great argument, because Apple's not going to make a $799 Air because of an Ultrabook. Because the Ultrabook, you won't get the Mac OS experience.
No, I don't think they're challenged by the Ultrabooks at all.
I don't think they care about
everything
that.
We've seen is the Ultrabooks don't sell anyway.
Right.
But that's for a lot of reasons, one of which is there's a new version of Windows coming out in the fall. And people in Windows world, historically, when people know there's another version of Windows, especially one that's so different, which means different hardware, touch hardware, and so forth, I think they just say, well, we'll wait. No problem. We'll wait till the fall. Windows XP isn't that bad.
This isn't a Pentium 2. This is a Pentium 3.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Hey, let's take a break. Come back with more. Darren Okada, Andy Yanatko, and you talking about Macs and iOS and all that stuff. Now, I know a lot of you have websites. Frequently, though, I think people are looking for – I get calls all the time, what's the best hosting? And I often will say, look, what you want is something that's more than just hosting. You want Squarespace. It's hosting plus analytics plus software plus 24/7 support. It's really the best place to create an amazing website. I want you to visit squarespace.com. If you haven't been there lately, you've got to take a look. They've really updated it. There's new templates. There's the new Google fonts, 300 fonts. They have Android, iPad, and iPhone apps that don't just let you post, by the way, but moderate comments, look at stats, all of that stuff. You know, it's really a full and really nicely done interface to your website. Blogs, photo galleries, e-commerce, all works great with Squarespace.com. I was talking to Odinga, I think he's in a chat room, who's the webmaster for the Nordic Light Photography Festival that I was at in Christensen, NLE.NO. And he moved them all to Squarespace. So everything. In fact, I think the whole town of Christensen is now going Squarespace, basically. His blog, here we are recording. We went up into a tower in Christensen and recorded. That's Bruce Davidson, who's one of the best photographers in the world. You would love his stuff, Andy. He's a street photographer, brilliant guy. You've seen many of his pictures. Anyway, Squarespace, entirely, everything, not only for the festival, for the blog, for personal blogs. Odinga is, I think if Squarespace suddenly notices a a blip, a cluster of new users in Kristiansand, Norway. You can thank Odd Inga, who's done this, because he loves it.
It looks great.
It really does. The nice thing about Squarespace is every site is unique. You start with their great templates, but you completely customize it. You don't have to know CSS or JavaScript, but they do. If you do, you can use it as well. In fact, they have a pop-out CSS editor that colors the code and does auto-completion and stuff. I mean, it's really kind of neat. They want to support everybody from the rank amateur, the brand-new beginner, to the CSS expert. I just really want you to try this. Oh, I should show workshops. They have also great workshops for free webinars to help you. I can't think of anybody who does this. They actually will give you free help and training on how to use the software to get the most out of it.
Oh, wow, that's great.
I know. Is that nice?
It's organized really well.
Oh, yeah, they did a great
really
job.
Really actually learn how to make your site better. That's
They've
cool.
done something this month. They're going to do something which I think is really great. A lot of people come to Squarespace and they want to create a site that has a unique, you know, custom domain name, DarrenOkada.com or something.
Nobody take that. I don't know if I renewed it.
Oh.
I don't have a site yet.
Darren, jump on it. Well, here's the deal. If you sign up with Squarespace for a one-year annual plan, they will give you the domain name free. They'll do all the connection and all that
really?
So that it automatically forwards. And you'll get an additional 10% off. So that's it's a pretty good deal right now.
You know, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Hassle-free setup, free domain name for all annual plan customers, and prices as low as $8 a month. But now, here's the deal. You've got to use our offer code MACBREAK5 when you buy. So click the Try It Free button. Set up your site. You'll have all the features so you can completely set up the site, including import all your existing stuff from other sites and so forth. And then if you decide you like it, sign up for the year plan and use MACBREAK5 as the offer code. By the way, very affordable. $8 a month for the annual plan for the basic site. If you get the unlimited site, it's only $16 a month. You get unlimited pages, unlimited bandwidth, and unlimited storage. I don't know how they even do that. Plus the free custom domain, plus all the support, and a whole lot more. I think you got to try it out. Squarespace.com. And remember, when you buy, you don't need it now to try it out, but when you buy, just use the offer code MACBREAK and the number 5 for the fifth month of the year for that special deal and 10% off your purchase. I love it. Squarespace.com. I like GigaOM. They wrote a nice article saying exactly what you said, Andy. You too, Darren. Erica Ogg writing, there's not because of a fear of Ultrabooks. Forget it. Apple fears nothing. Certainly not puny Ultrabooks. I do have, and I'm going to review for before you buy, the new Dell XPS 13 Ultrabook. And it's great because it's basically a MacBook Air. SSD, i7, thin, light, beautiful aluminum, you know, all of that. It's just a MacBook Air.
I will not make fun of these manufacturers for copying a really great design.
Exactly.
That's just smart.
That's just smart. That's like,
thanks for the R&D investment at Apple. We want to take up the torch that you didn't drop.
So one more rumor we'll kind of cover, and this is the liquid metal. And I don't even think this is a rumor. The guy who created liquid metal, which is a new metallic alloy, Apple has used it in a very trivial way. You know the SIM, the poker that removes the SIM in the iPhone? That's made of liquid metal. But he says they're going to use it in a very significant way going forward. And that's when the rumor mill went crazy, saying, oh, it must be the iPhone 5. I don't know if times are – this is early days in this process. I don't know if they can actually use liquid metal to do something like a unibody.
Yeah, I think they do have a period where they have to figure out the fabrication.
It may be a ways off.
It really is like that scene in Star Trek II where you have the secrets of transparent aluminum, but you have not yet figured out exactly how to manufacture and actually use it.
Right. However, go ahead.
From the context of the interview that I read, I think that when he was saying that it's going to be used in a breakthrough product, my interpretation within context of the interview wasn't that there is a specific breakthrough product that Apple is targeting this towards, more that sometime in the future there's going to be a design problem for which liquid metal is the perfect solution, and at that time they're going to find that they've solved the engineering problems, and they've been waiting to not just say, we're not going to make a MacBook Air out of liquid metal just so that we can say we've made it out of liquid metal.
Right.
We're going to make sure that this is the solution to a problem. Remember the titanium PowerBook that was cool material, really looked great on a poster. Then you realize that, it's great for the skin of an airplane, not that great for a skin of a notebook. I mean, it got cracks, it got tears.
Right.
I think in the first one, they didn't understand how it would affect the shielding on the internal Wi-Fi antennas. So I'm sure that they're smart enough to not make that mistake again.
I'm just looking for rumors about the iPhone 5.
I think this is what they're waiting to do the Apple TV in.
Oh, yeah, liquid metal. It'll be like the Terminator 3 or
it's
whatever.
Their breakthrough product.
Yeah.
You can lift it up with one finger.
I think they're going to do like the 30th century Mac, where they say, well, screw it. It costs $90,000.
Why not?
It's made out of unobtainium. It hovers over your desk.
Why not?
And blue cat-like creatures will put a 3-foot-long arrow through your heart for buying one.
So it is notable that Apple has decided to sue to gain control of the domain iPhone5.com or not. They probably sue for every iPhone variation,
exactly.
Right?
The fact that it has the word iPhone in it is good enough.
See, I'm just trying to find some rumors that...
That's okay. It's after the Apple TV stuff, it's good to be able to be
solid.
On a topic where I have a definitive opinion.
Something solid.
Yeah.
I love this. The AT&T, I don't know, did you talk about this last week? The CEO of AT&T, Randall Stephenson, saying the worst mistake I ever made was offering unlimited data on the iPhone.
No, I think that was after the show.
He says he wished the company had never offered an unlimited data plan for the device, and he loses sleep. He loses sleep over free texting services like iMessage.
Give me a break.
The reason why he's losing sleep is that he keeps all those bundles of $1,000 bills in the mattress.
Yeah.
Okay. If he went to like one of those memory foam mattresses, he'd do just fine.
If AT&T hadn't offered unlimited data, it would have been able to get people who use more data to pay up, as opposed to having the light users subsidize the heavy ones.
Yeah, because you forget how quickly they withdrew the unlimited data plan,
right?
And how many iPhones and how many iPads have been sold since they turned that off? They turned that off like after 6 weeks, with new iPad buyers can no longer get unlimited data, and we also forget AT&T was sort of a second tier, maybe even a third tier carrier. Before the iPhone hit, iPhone really helped AT&T build itself up. They were definitely a second or third tier carrier back then. And the fact that they did whatever they had to do to close that deal and get the iPhone, I think on balance has to be one of the smartest things ever. I mean, you can regret the fact that you still have I don't know how many subscribers that are still getting $30 a month all you can eat access. But I mean. Is he saying that AT&T is doing nothing to throttle down? Like after you get, I don't know, towards 30 gigabytes of usage a month, maybe the bandwidth goes down 3%. Has he ever thought about that? Is he tempted to do that? Or is he actually doing that right now?
I think he's doing it if you go past 2 gigabytes, as a matter of fact. But
he's trying to blame iMessage as stealing money out of his piggy bank.
Last quarter, AT&T made $6.1 billion on mobile data. $6.1 billion on mobile data alone. 70% of the people on tiered data plans were buying the most expensive option. 70%. We're all going, I'll take whatever you can get. He says, you lie awake at night.
I bet.
You lie awake at night. Worrying about that which will disrupt your business model. iMessage is a classic example. If you're using iMessage, you're not using one of our messaging services, right? That's disruptive to our messaging revenue stream. I'd like to know how much money they make on SMS messages.
You know, if their phone service was better, you wouldn't have to iMessage. You can just talk to them.
But also, now I feel as though this statement from him comes with an implied warranty of make fun ability. So let's go through all the things that have not been keeping him awake at night. Children starving to death in a world
doesn't
filled
bother
with
him.
Plenty.
No.
Okay.
No.
Species dying off by the thousands, absolutely needlessly.
No.
Ignorance, want,
sleeping
despair,
sleeping like a baby.
Doesn't exactly.
Nope.
But the fact that not enough people are paying 25 cents per text message, that gets him just in.
Now, I have to say, he's at Michael Milken's Global Institute Congress, so I don't know. Maybe he felt like this was an audience that would just, you get me. You really get me. It is true that the mobile industry worldwide is suffering a decline in text messaging, but not in the United States. Text messaging is still growing. It's growing more slowly. But it's such a big revenue stream. We did the calculation once. If you pay 20 cents per 160-character message, it's like $2,000 a megabyte of data. I mean, some ridiculous amount. So maybe at some point they will make less money on texting than they do now. But it's not today. It's not tomorrow. He also said Skype poses a threat. Now, that's true, right?
Yeah.
But he doesn't regret the decision to support the smartphone.
Oh, yeah.
Good for you.
The phone that's made AT&T be AT&T right now. Yeah.
Also, Touchtone was a great idea in retrospect.
He was chairman of the Singular board at the time. It was Singular. This is how long ago when Steve Jobs first approached AT&T, now at the time Singular. Mr. Jobs met with, remember Stan Sigman? Remember when Stan Sigman walked on stage in the Apple iPhone announcement? He was the CEO at Singular. After the meeting, Mr. Sigman approached the board to talk about a, quote, unique opportunity. He hadn't even seen a picture of the iPhone, but he described a device with a touchscreen that one would use to make calls, do email, and run apps. The board was nervous. By the way, I don't think that he said run apps because there were no apps on the original iPhone, but the board was nervous, so this is a little revisionist, about the Apple smartphone because it was aware that it would transform its business model. This just tells you why big companies suck. It could change things. I remember asking the question, he said, Mr. Stevenson, are we investing in a business model? Are we investing in a product? Or are we investing in Steve Jobs? The answer was, you're investing in Steve Jobs. Let's go. Wow. But that just shows you why. These, you know, the record industry, TV industry, the phone, cell phone industry, why they suck so bad. Because anything that changes the business model, for good or bad, makes them lose sleep.
Yeah, they're scared.
They don't want to change anything.
Like to back off a little bit, because I'm feeling a little bit guilty because I did say that he cares more about money lost from text messaging than children dying.
He might be losing sleep for many reasons.
Maybe I should. Exactly. There are many reasons to lose sleep. Perhaps it's like the third Thursday of the month is the day.
I lose sleep because I had clams for dinner. I mean, you know, you can lose sleep for a lot of reasons.
Exactly. It is difficult to imagine when you have a system that's worked for you for decades, that put your dollar here in 30 days, you'll get $1.40 from over here. When someone comes up to you and says that here is a way that will ensure that you'll still be making money 5 years from now, but you have to have a little bit of faith that won't destroy your 10-year-old way of making money. That is a leap of faith. That is a leap of logic, and not a whole lot of companies are capable of doing that.
Right. So I'll tell you, so this was such a benefit to AT&T that Sprint, when it got the opportunity to get the iPhone, was willing to sink $15 billion into the iPhone. In fact, they pay a $200 higher subsidy per device than on any other phone they sell at Sprint. And, of course, still they wanted it. But apparently the shareholders were a little peeved. So Sprint CEO's Dan Hesse is going to take a pay cut. He's going to lose $3.25 million in his salary because, to mollify shareholders who say you spent too much to get the iPhone. Sprint sold 1.5 million iPhones in the first quarter, 1.8 million in Q4, and 44% of the new iPhones sold during Q1 were customers who had not been Sprint customers before.
Wow.
New customers. 660,000 new customers. You know, shareholders, you might back off Dan a little bit.
Yeah, bringing in business.
Give him a break.
Long-term business.
Give him a break.
I wonder if he's losing any sleep.
$3.25 million a year. I'd lose some sleep. T-Mobile does not have the iPhone. There's the guy who should be losing sleep. Whoever's in charge of T-Mobile.
He's making a ton of money off of text messaging, right?
Yeah, right. Hey, I don't have to worry because we have text messaging. T-Mobile is, though, going to roll out a 4G network that's compatible with the iPhone, hoping, I think, that to take advantage of these unlocked iPhones that'll be coming into the market. And you know, you can use our 4G network on the new iPhone. It could be a coincidence, but they wanted to use this 1900 megahertz band, which is, I guess, the same band as AT&T.
Oh, really?
Yeah. T-Mobile says the iPhone will be technically supported, but no deal between Apple and T-Mobile has been struck.
So if you just happen to have an iPhone in your pocket or somebody else's pocket...
Well, didn't Apple, or was it AT&T? It was AT&T that said that we will unlock it after 2 years.
Oh, really?
Or was Apple? Yep. But AT&T does the unlocking, yeah. Once you've paid off your contract, we'll unlock the phone for you.
So well, he should be losing sleep over that. That's how he's going to lose customers.
T-Mobile, yeah, really. T-Mobile in April said that there are 1 million unlocked iPhones on our network. 1 million. But they're running on Edge. So I think this makes sense. Yeah. All right, more numbers. 90, this is like a duh. 95% of all tablet web traffic comes from the iPad.
I'm surprised.
Really?
Wow, really?
Well, it just shows you that Android and the BlackBerry's playbook, what other tablets are there, have not really kind of
done much. HP Touchpad?
Touchpad. The Galaxy tablet has 1.22% market share. That's the best-selling Android tablet, I think. The Kindle Fire, it's interesting. Sales apparently are dropping a little bit. Hmm. The Fire is not. The Nook has 0.53 of the web traffic. Of course, it's really more of a reader. Kindle Fire is almost at the bottom. 0.8% of all.
Well, I would think once you've downloaded a book you want to read on the Fire, you're not going to be accessing the web as much. Whereas yes, with the iPad, we're always hitting the web.
So this is an interesting graph. This comes from Chitika, which is, I guess, an analyst. The average number of tablets per 100 iPads. So for every 100 iPad on the net, there's about 1.3 Samsung Galaxy Tabs. There's about 1.2 Transformer Primes. I'm surprised the Zoom did pretty well. The Motorola Zoom, just a little under one Zoom per 100 iPads. Hmm. A little over 0.8 Playbooks per 100 iPads. Kindle Fire, same. And then the Nook is 0.53. 0.5. So there's 0.8 Nook, 0.8 Kindle Fires for every 100 iPads on the internet. Now, I guess you could buy a Fire and not use it on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people are buying them as a multi-use tablet. They really are using it as a consumption device. So that's not as painful a statistic as, you know, Samsung and Motorola saying,
that's
yes,
gotta hurt.
Here is our challenger to the iPad, which nobody has apparently heard of or is using or is writing software for. I mean, there's probably more software development on the malware side of business than in the actual productivity side of business.
Right.
I mean, I posted my tame, restrained 3,000-word review of iPhoto for iPad this week on the Sun Times site, and I really couldn't avoid saying that in summing up how good an app iPhoto is and what it can do, that it really does underscore how it's not a bad situation that Android has for tablets. It's not even a come from behind situation. They're just taking 3 steps forward and 12 steps back with every single release. They have nothing.
They have
absolutely nothing. It's as though they haven't released anything in the last 2 years. They have achieved nothing.
And I think iPhoto is a really good example of, because like you, you know, I usually use Lightroom on a desk, on a laptop, and I did bring my laptop to Norway, but because I was going to be on the train, I thought, well, I'll just, for a change, I'll import my, use the camera, connection kit and import right from the camera. And these are, by the way, you know, big files. They're 12 megabyte Canon 5D Mark II RAW files. Import them in. iPhoto took them. It was easier to modify these monster files and do everything I needed. I got great images. This was as good as Lightroom almost. It was all on my iPad. I'm sitting on the train going, and before the train ride was over, I had a slideshow that I then handed around.
I think it's brilliant for triaging photos. I mean, I don't think I've ever taken a trip. There are trips, and usually in a trip like this, I will take at least 100 photos a day, usually somewhere around 200 or 300 photos. And sometimes it can be months before I've actually managed to cull that down into 50 or 60 things I actually want to keep and put into a library. With this one, it's like not even an afternoon would go by the time that I decided to just I've got 30 minutes to kill, 5 minutes to slurp the most recent 80 pictures into iPhoto,
exactly.
Another 10 minutes to isolate the ones that are really, really good. And just like you said, to the great distress and dismay of all my friends back home, as soon as I got off the plane, I had a slideshow I could show them. And if they wanted to taste any of the whiskey that I brought home with me, they were going to have to sit and watch that slideshow.
It really was a wonderful experience. And there is a nice thing about doing it in touch compared to doing it with a mouse. I still can do a lot more with Lightroom, and I think probably the black and white processing I'm going to do with the Nick, silver effects is going to be better. But I was able to get a pretty darn good quick approximation. And I think you hit the nail on the head. What I mostly used it for was selection.
Yeah.
Because you're looking on a nice screen on the new iPad. It really looks nice. And you can say, no, I don't want that one. Now, Andy, what do you do then? Do you then sync up your iPad and use the RAWs from the iPad, or do you go back and then?
Yeah, that's the only thing. I wish that if the iPhoto doesn't know from RAW, it doesn't understand RAW. You can view RAW, but you can't even do anything with it. I would have loved if usually with my camera, I'm shooting RAW plus JPEG pairs. That way, iPhoto could edit the JPEG and post them. For Flickr and sharing.
You know, I had a like different experience, Andy. I only imported RAWs, and I did everything in RAWs on my Canon CR2 RAW files.
Really?
Really.
Because iOS doesn't know how to decode RAWs.
Well, I didn't import anything else.
Okay. I mean, it's possible.
It said RAW on the image. It says RAW, and I picked the image.
Okay.
It must be JPEGing it or something, but it reads it.
What it can do is the standard photo roll, it can certainly import RAWs and then export them later on when you hook it up to whatever your desktop image processing or image library app is. But iPhoto does not know how to edit RAW.
So it must be converting the RAW to JPEG.
It can't even convert it into JPEG.
Well, then I don't understand what I was doing because I was not importing JPEGs. I was importing
RAWs. Unfortunately, you've inspired me to go back and double check. That was the one thing that of the review that there are a lot of things about iPhoto that are not really
here. Here it is. This is from support note HT5182. Thank you, ScooterX. When you import a RAW image to your iPad, and it does say RAW on the iPhoto, iPhoto will display only the JPEG version of the image embedded in the RAW file.
Oh, so it's like the proxy that's embedded into that.
I didn't even know that the Canon was embedding a JPEG.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. On top of everything else, iPhoto has an upper limit of 19 megapixels per image.
Right.
Also, and the double whammy is that it's not that it'll downsample it to 16; it'll downsample it by a factor of 4. So if you have a 24 megapixel image like from the Canon D800, it becomes a 6 megapixel image.
And I knew that I was degrading the images. And what I was hoping is that if I then deleted images I knew I didn't want and then synced up, that those RAWs would be then copied over and I could do the final editing in Lightroom or Photoshop.
I wish that for the next version of iPhoto, what I really wish that it would do is because iPhoto has its own internal library. That a photo library that you don't access directly, but every time that you have iPhoto operate on an image or make an image active, it will automatically copy that JPEG into its own internal library. So it becomes very, very simple to take all the, if I were just shooting JPEGs, it would be very, very simple to simply with like maybe 4 taps of the screen, say, please export all of my favorited images to iTunes. And I could simply copy them over and then just erase all the photos that I'd imported over the course of the week. But since I'm shooting RAW, The RAWs will not be copied into the internal iPhoto library. So I have to to answer your question, what I was doing was I was really using iPhoto to generate all the stuff that I was going to be sharing on Flickr. And then when I got back home, I really just had to sort of manually take a look and refresh my memory as to which ones I was actually using in iPhoto in the actual camera app, and then select those and add those RAW images into my Aperture library. So I'll have the higher density version for my library.
There's got to be some sort of clever way of letting Aperture know what I've done on iPhoto.
Right, or just have iPhoto say, I recognize that I've got two files of the exact same file name on this memory card. One ends in .jpg, right. The other ends in RW2 or whatever. I'm going to copy both of them into my own internal library, and whenever someone tries to export the JPEG, I'm also going to put that into iTunes.
The RAW export. In as well. Oh. Yeah. So
I love it.
I think that the bottom line is, if you're going to do what I did and what Andy's been doing in iPhoto, is do not use the embedded JPEG, because that's pretty low quality. I think that's done mostly for the back of the camera.
Exactly.
Yeah. You do turn on JPEG RAW plus JPEG and use a high quality JPEG, and then you'll have the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's incredible, though. It's like now they can get a high speed 32 gigabyte card for for $12. You don't even have to I have to admit that I wasn't even syncing things back off of my iPad. I just simply took the same card that I had inside my camera and hooked it up. I didn't even bother to get the RAWs off, because there really is no point really in deleting stuff off of your camera card anymore, because you can be the most Hessian aggression shooter during a vacation and still come home with at least 8 to 10 gigabytes worth of free space left in the card.
Yeah. Yeah,
I love the 21st century. Don't you?
I have four 16 gig cards and one 8 gig card, and I filled them up with both. We shot a lot of video for Twit Photo.
Video is the killer
on there. But I filled them up, but I didn't have to erase any. I had enough
cards,
and
to
I
last
brought them all back. So that I had the originals on the cards, and of course I made copies onto two different hard drives: one in my carry on, one in my checked, and and then I think we left a copy in Norway just in case. So that worked out quite well. You, by the way, all those photos and more will be available not this week on Twit Photo, but starting next week on Twit Photo. We're going to do a 2-part special on the Nordic Light Festival. Was it amazing photo festival? Just incredible. Hey, if you're buying an iPad, this is interesting. And Gadget tracked this down. The late model iPad 2s, known as in the system information as 2.4, is a 32 nanometer processor as opposed to the 45 nanometer chips in the other iPad 2s. You'll get better battery life. Actually, this comes from a non-tech. 16% increase in battery life, 30% boost when playing games, 16% during web browsing. So that the thing to do is, if you can, when you buy an iPad 2, even if you're buying a brand new one, see if you can find out if it's the 32 nanometer process one. I would guess all the new iPad 2s would be that way, right?
How do you find out?
You can't. No way to know. So that's not from Engadget. I should give a credit to Anandtech. They do such great work. The iPad 2.4 review. Talk about great work. Who knew there was another edition of the iPad 2? It's the 32 nanometer A5. I don't know. I bookmarked this. I don't even know if it's worth mentioning. Some of us want, I don't particularly, but many people apparently want multi-user support on the iPad, so different people can use the same iPad, log in and so forth. Apple says it's currently being investigated.
Not after this operating system. Yeah. Flaw.
Somebody reported it as they used the Apple bug reporter, but not as a bug report, but as a suggestion. The developer said the company should add support for multiple users of the iPad. Apple responded officially after further investigation. It has been determined this is a known issue, which is, I think this might be boilerplate.
Yeah,
which is currently being investigated. That's got to be boilerplate. We're going to investigate this.
I think the monkey touched the wrong button. there's just a line of very well cared for monkeys that get the banana pellets. They touch the, we're looking into this. Thank you very much for your looking. Hi, we're going to sue you and try to buy your domain name, and a big green one that says ignore. I think they touched the wrong
button. If you thought you were going to make millions of dollars with your iOS app, think again. Only about 40% of developers even make any money. 60% don't even break even. So there, just mention that. There is, I got it right here.
Stay in dental school, kids.
Stay in dental school. Apps are not going to change your life. There is an update to iOS 5.1.1. Download and install. I love it that we don't have to, you know, sync up anymore. I agree to this very long terms and condition. Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
I read this all, by the way. Every word on the iPhone. Can you zoom it? No. No, no. That would make it too easy to read. I guess you could probably email it. Connect your phone to a power source. Okay, whatever. And there you go. So we're going to – it's improvements and bug fixes. It fixes AirPlay, network bugs. I think that there is a fix to the camera. There's something about the way the camera works. When you're coming into the camera out of lock
mode. HDR option for photos taken.
It works better.
Screen lock.
Oh, so you didn't have HDR at all before. Better syncing of bookmarks and reading list. If you've ever seen the unable to purchase alert after a successful purchase, I have.
I have, but my credit card's been maxed. That's
been fixed. And apparently, the jailbreakers have already jailbroken it.
Oh, God.
Golly, that was fast. Good news, Apple finally is acknowledging the use of OpenStreetMap data in iPhoto. Speaking of iPhoto, I'm not crazy about the iPhoto maps and the journal thing. I made a journal of Norway, but I couldn't zoom in and enough. It was hard to zoom in. Didn't have streets. They have been using 2-year-old mapping data from the OpenStreetMap team, and the app now credits OpenStreetMap as it is required to do so by the license. Apple didn't credit them at first, but that's good. I love OpenStreetMap, and I don't want to see them hurt. Finally, we'll end, and then we'll go to our tips of the week, but we'll end with this, because I think, Darren, you had something to do with it.
This blows me away. I was so surprised.
This surfaced. This was shot for a sales video, right?
Yeah, it was in 1984.
This is from 1984.
Yeah, it was a sales gathering that they were going to have in Honolulu, and just to get all their salespeople and people own. Remember when they used to own little stores and you go buy?
Used to have third party salespeople.
Yeah.
So instead of 1984, the bit is it's 1944.
General, you and your brave fighting force.
And Steve Jobs plays FDR.
Your battle will be
long. Steve.
It will be hard, but it will be won.
So,
I'm sure your
did you shoot this?
I shot this. It blows me away to see this.
You didn't even know that this.
Insanely great.
He had a great sense of humor. We had a lot of fun.
That is funny. You have a fake Oval Office, Steve Jobs at the big desk with flags, but the flags are Apple flags.
Yeah. I mean, there's the longer version that I saw on here.
There's
that has
it's 9 minutes.
The entire thing, and
yeah.
it's a play on everything Apple and how IBM's the enemy. But I was telling Eileen earlier that we shot for 2 days this film, and we didn't know when Steve was going to be able to be there.
Right.
So this little Oval Office and chair, we said, well, let's just...
leave it there.
No, let's just put it in the back of a truck.
Really?
Because we were out in the in a place where we had...
It's in the back of a truck?
Yeah, and it's like, well, we'll take it out when Steve gets here. I won't make him get in the truck to shoot his piece.
Yeah.
Because we had no idea when he was going to be there.
Right.
And he finally arrived, and they said, well, he's only going to have an hour, and
so you made him get in the truck.
No, actually, we did set it up, and after we were done, I mean, he was a little nervous at first, and then he just started having fun with it. And
did you know that somebody must have known that he could do an FDR impression?
No, we had no idea. In fact,
it's quite good, actually. Did you have to coach him?
Yeah, there was a little bit of coaching, but in fact, there was an actor waiting in the wings in case this all just blew up. But
That poor actor. He was going to be FDR.
Yeah, but, he got paid anyway. But, yeah, all this stuff, we created all this World War II, shot it in black and white, 16 millimeter.
What fun. And it's just resurfaced. Every company does this for their sales meetings and so forth.
Yeah.
Microsoft has some great videos, but I've never seen anything like this from Apple. This is really cool.
It was because there was so much seriousness going on, we just mocked everything about
it.
Right.
So, this was early in the – this was when the Mac first came out.
Just releasing the Mac, yeah.
Yeah. And they're fighting at IBM still, which just tells you something.
Exactly.
Because I don't think that that's really an issue anymore.
No, it's interesting how things have changed around.
Yeah, no kidding. Apple fighting IBM.
We actually had a few jokes in there about software because that was the big question about the Mac.
Yeah, there was no software.
No software.
Yeah. This is very
funny. But I had not seen this over 20 years ago.
Wow.
And last night I was going over, you know, the show notes that Eileen sent, and then I clicked on this.
You said, oh my God, that's my old video.
I just like fell over.
Isn't that funny? Steve Jobs is FDR. You can find it. It actually was published at networkworld.com in the Buzz blog by Paul McNamara. And I don't know how he found this.
Yeah, I don't know how he found it either.
Everything lives now, you know? There's nothing you've ever done that doesn't live on.
And there are people who deny that he wanted to dress up like Willy Wonka for the 1 millionth iMac sold. I think this sheds some light on another story from last week.
That's right. Yeah.
So the story about how they found this is kind of interesting because two snippets for this movie without any dialogue appear in a photo montage tribute to Steve that Apple employees made to mark his 30th birthday, which would have been a year later. When Steve Jobs died in October, somebody posted that birthday video on his Facebook page. So that was the first time anybody had seen it in 25 years. It went viral. And then Sony Music Entertainment pulled it down because it had a Bob Dylan song in it. But not before somebody else started to dig and say, I remember that. Where is that 1944 video? Thank you, Sony.
Yeah.
They're like the cops who told the Beatles to climb down off that rooftop and just stop making noise.
Yeah.
They're captain and major of the No Fun Brigade.
Stop making noise. Jeez Louise. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We're going to have your tips, your picks, and more. Darren Okada is here. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here.
The man who made the 1944 commercial. Or video. Wow. I mean, that is a coincidence.
Looks good for an 87-year-old man.
Total coincidence.
Isn't that bizarre?
No idea.
You were just 12 at the time.
I was...
a young man. Just out of film school, probably.
You know? No, I was just begged for a job. And
you didn't work for Apple.
No.
No.
But Steve did give me an Apple coffee cup.
Oh, that was nice of him.
Had a
not a Mac, just an Apple
coffee
cup.
Not a Mac. Yeah, here's a coffee cup. And because they had a lot of Apple.
There's a guy walking behind Steve with a box of coffee cups, probably.
It was the color Apple logo.
Yeah. It was the color one, yeah.
Did he ask to keep the glasses? Because those would pop up 30 years later.
I think we sent all of it there in case he wanted to pop up on stage dressed like that.
That's actually pretty funny because you're right. He then adapted those FDR glasses later when he needed them. Hey, I want to talk a little bit about Pond 5 before we continue on. Pond 5, the world's stock media marketplace. They were such great sponsors at NAB, and they're just such a great company. If you go to pond5.com, you can take a look at what they do. They, for both media makers and media users, and actually I think there's a kind of a big crossover because if you are a photographer, you make video or illustrations, you do music or, you know, podcasts, you also, you know, you probably make some of these and you also probably use some of these in your own creations. And that's why it's so cool. When you create a Pond 5 account, you can buy or sell. And boy, look what they've got in here. 5,000, almost 6,000 new video clips to their million clip collection. 7.6 million stock photos, 680,000 illustrations, 77,000 music tracks, 250,000 sound effects, even After Effects projects, 27 new After Effects projects this week alone. Just browse around. This is kind of fun. You want to see sea lions in the Galapagos? Sure. There's a whole collection. That's the beauty of this. There is so much stuff on stock video and photos and everything on Pond 5 that you there's, and it's high def and it's affordable. $15 for some seals. And the thing is, this is royalty free. That means you pay once and you own it. Prices start at $5 for stock video and music, $2 for sound effects. Every week, a free stock video clip. Let's see what this is. This is this week's free clip. Dunraven, extreme wide view group of scuba divers above shipwreck. Now, see, that would be great for my next, you know, PowerPoint presentation or something. Isn't that cool? 1080p, and it's free. Now, here's the deal. Go to pond5.com. If you're a media maker, you're going to want to check out their industry-leading royalty rates. They split the deal 50-50, which is pretty amazing.
That's a great deal.
For stock photos?
Wow.
That's unheard of. They let you set the price, too, so you get what you want. If you are a video buyer, the collection here is amazing. The browsing makes it so easy for you to find what you want. You know, you can listen to sound effects just right in there. You can listen to music. You can even, look, here's audio logos. You know, we should just use these for some of our shows. Let me just... It's time for MacBreak Weekly. See, they put a little, that's a little watermark in there. We'd have to
Pay for that. I've never heard of an audio watermark. That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Yeah, well, you have to, right?
Yeah, I never crossed my mind how to do that.
So somebody who's like good with a keyboard or good with Logic or something is making these. And they're affordable.
How much is that?
$4.
One?
Here's a business corporate raindrops. Welcome.
You are strong. You are powerful. You can sell. With mind isometric exercises, you can walk into your prospect and meet your quota.
Here's
week
one
after week.
Here's one called News of Science. We should use this for Dr. Kiki. And now it's time for the Science Minute.
Very House MD.
It is Very House MD. Anyway, check it out, pond5.com. 25% off your purchase this month when you use the offer code TWIT25. 25% off your purchase this month when you use the offer code TWIT25. I love these guys. They're really nice. Really great guys, and I really want them to do well.
I'm going to try putting some stuff up on that just for fun.
You should. I know people who do this and are very, very happy. You could probably get a ton of stock footage. Stuff that you've been shooting.
Yeah, I just have to kind of put that pattern over the actors' faces so we don't know who they were.
Nah, don't worry about it. You got releases. Time for our iOS tip of the week. Are you going to do this, Andy?
I have a macOS tip, but I have something that will also bridge as
I see an iOS tip, sharing your Wi-Fi connection. Is that, who put that in?
That's mine.
For Alex, and he's not here, so... Because Alex had problems, so we won't use that. Go ahead and give us the macOS tip.
Okay, this actually comes courtesy of Ted Landau, who tweeted it the other day and got so much love from the rest of the world for solving a problem that people have been bothered with since Lion came out. If you ever have to deal with old documents, the big pain in the butt is that they're automatically locked by the operating system against changes. So if you try to open them, all these Mac apps will keep telling you, "Oh, I'm sorry, I can make a copy of it for you and duplicate it if you want to actually, you know, scroll through it and double click in something." But unfortunately, I'm not going to let you do that. There's actually a setting that will disable that, but it's buried deep, 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 deep in Time Machine. If you go into System Preferences, click on the settings for Time Machine, you'll find an options tab that lets you set how much time passes before a document gets locked. And you will also have the ability to, I believe, disable that completely. Now, I do think that keeping old documents locked is kind of a really good idea, given that as we move forward into 10.8, the operating system believes that every single document there's no such thing as an official version of a document anymore. This is a ongoing record of everything you've ever done to it. And sometimes if you've got a document that you last opened 10 years ago, it really is, you really want it to be frozen in amber. So I wouldn't want to disable this permanently, but there's so many times when I am trying to triage an old CD or an old DVD of documents and trying to find that one image file from this event I went to 10 years ago that I want to resurface in a presentation or something. And man, is it a pain in the butt to always have to unlock things and duplicate things in order to actually work with a file. So yeah, you'll want to use that to turn it off for the time being and then turn it back on again maybe when you get done with the end of the day.
That explains why I keep getting this message. Document is locked. Do you want to duplicate it? Now I understand. I turned it on. Good tip, Andy Yannatko. Now let's get our picks of the week. And I'm going to start because I never get to get my pick in because we always run out of time. So I'm going to do it now. If we run out of time, it's your fault.
Okay.
This actually, I'm not a programmer, but there is a new way of writing software for iOS, native iOS apps. I think people don't perhaps know that you have a choice of languages. I think a lot of people say, well, you have to use Xcode and you have to use Objective-C if you're going to develop for iOS. And it's not so at all. You have to use the iOS APIs and everything. But this is new and I think is very cool. $150. It's called Ruby Motion. And it lets you, instead of writing in Objective-C, write in Ruby. Use the command line to and Ruby's rake tool, which is its make file, to create everything you need to deploy your app, including a ready app for the App Store. I'm very interested in this. You don't actually use Xcode. You use your own whatever editor you like. You do use the simulator, of course. I'm very interested in this as a way to quickly create and deploy iOS apps, maybe purpose-built iOS apps, not necessarily apps you want to sell, although it will, in fact, work just fine for apps you want to sell. I think it's very cool. RubyMotion.com if you're interested in knowing more. Darren, your tip of the week, my friend.
Mine is, it's a web app called Asana. And you can look at it at asana.com. And the videos on it are great. I use it for organizing task lists because I've tried every way and it always goofs up. But this has actually been something that's worked really intuitively. It's simple. I think the easiest thing to do is just time-wise, just look at the videos because the videos are really a clear-cut way of how to use this.
Is it designed mostly for sharing with a team, or do you use it for your own stuff?
You can do both, which is great. Okay. So, and it'll email you every day a list
Here's
of what
you need
to do.
Like that.
And it's just simple, and I can get it on my iPad, use it on a lot of different platforms, and incorporate things. But the way that you can move stuff around is the way we sort of think. You're not locked into a structure, which I found a lot of these task apps have you do. I spend more time trying to figure out how to do it, but this does it very freeform. If there's an idea while I'm driving, somewhere, I'll just email it and it'll go right into the top. And then once I open it, just drag it to where I need it.
Oh, I'm going to sign up for this. What's it cost?
It's a Asana, and you can sign up and do a free account for a bit until you.
I'm going to use my Google account because allow access to Asana. And then I don't have to do anything more elaborate,
I've used it for organizing production shoots, just anything that comes into my head of, not having a piece of paper or an iPad to type it out.
Right. Asana, A-S-A-N-A .com. And they do have, as you said, a lot of videos so that you don't have to you can learn this with help.
Yeah, I mean, it's the clearest instructional videos I've ever
I'm
seen.
Always looking for a better way to do it. I've bought every to-do app there is.
Yeah, me too. And there's always an issue with it. There's, right. And you end up not using it. So.
Yeah.
But this
good.
One is
I'll
good.
I'll check it out. Thank you. Your pick of the week, Andy Yannatko.
This is another Ireland trip related pick of the week. I went to a lot of museums, and there are a lot of places where you're not allowed to take pictures. And so that's the time when fortunately, I had my iPad with me, so I decided to sit down and actually do some sketches of what I was seeing.
Oh.
Not because I'm a real artist, but because it's nice. When you get to the point where you want to remember what it was like to be in a place, even like a really weak, stupid sketch is better than like having absolutely nothing. And like this is, so this is like a inside the library.
That's cool.
Earlier. So this is like a really, really cool book that was there.
So it's really a memory for you. It's not something you're going to.
Yeah, I mean, it's not terribly good. I will say, though, this is the paper app is not my pick of the week, but I probably if you sit in a library doing like for an hour doing sketches on an iPad, you will learn five different foreign languages in which you can say, what app is that? So I believe I heard it in English. I heard it in French. I heard it in German.
Was ist das?
Exactly.
Was
ist das? The iPad app? called Papers. Also paper. Yeah, just P-A-P-E.
Paper's quite beautiful. Quite amazing. Yeah.
So it's a nice app. But it reminded me that I really, really should like be traveling with a stylus. And so that led to like a week later, really from that hotel room, like I bought like probably three or four of them. And my favorite is something you probably saw at Macworld Expo. This is from Adonit, wow. A-D-O-N-I-T, the Jot Pro. It's a really cool idea in that the problem with Stylus is that the iPad's scanner is designed to react to this a surface the size of a fingertip, which means that you always have to be dealing with this really, really huge, like magic marker-sized stylus. What they did is that they decided to make a ballpoint-type stylus, but put this little disc of plastic on the end of it. So as far as the iPad is concerned, it's got this big, fat disc that it can read correctly. As far as your eye is concerned, though, you've got this really nice pinpoint control. Lost focus. Sorry about that. You've got this really nice pinpoint thing, so you can actually do fine lines. You can actually sort of see like the difference, a minor version of that on this sketch right here, where I wanted to like write down what the book was that I was copying the artwork from. On the bottom, that's as big as tiny lettering as I could possibly draw with my fingertip. At the top, there is actually what I actually wanted to write because. As soon as I got it, I tried to rewrite it, and you can get really fine cross-hatching. You can get really fine lines. And again, even if you're just sort of not a real artist, but just someone who just doodles, it's so frustrating when you really want to put a line right exactly there, or you want two lines to actually intersect and touch right there, but there's absolutely no way to do it when you're just using your finger. This is just really wonderful, and it gives you some modicum of control. The bad news is that when your sketch turns out lousy, you can't blame the fact that you didn't have a stylus with you. There's no excuses if you have the Jot Pro. It's not terribly expensive. Most styluses that are any good at all cost between $15 and $25. This one costs all of $30. But again, if it's something that you want to have handy with you, it's certainly worth it. I just wish that they had thought to put an actual clip on it, so I won't lose it inside my pocket.
Yeah,
but, you go to a good old timey office supply store, or go to Amazon. You can actually buy a pencil clip and put it on that way. So I've got one of those on order too. So add another $3 to the cost.
This was actually a Kickstarter project about a year ago. Hmm.
Yeah, and it was one of those few Kickstarter projects that is actually exactly as good as the video.
Yeah.
seriously, you get it, and it's like, oh, that was a great video, not quite so much a good product.
Right, I'm glad right.
I'm waiting a year for it. The only caveat I'll put on it is that most styluses, they're made out of soft rubber. And so if you're the sort of person who uses a stylus to actually take notes, the Adonit, remember, that's hard plastic and that's hard like metal. It won't scratch the iPad at all, but if you're taking notes, everyone in the room will hear tap 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 as you write. So maybe better for sketching and drawing than note taking. But if you're sketching and drawing, best one that I've found so far.
The Verge did a quite good review that somebody in the chat room mentioned, the best styli for the iPad, and they include that and among many, many others. I think they reviewed what looks like about 9 or 10 of them. There are a lot out there right now. So, depending on what you're looking for.
I think the two best are that one and whatever cheap no-name one you can get, like for $20, because it's very likely that this, I have to be really careful with this one, because I am the sort of person who can't have like a nice $50 pen, because at some point I will lose it somewhere. I won't lose it in the library, but I'll lose it somewhere in the house. I will never be able to find it when I need it.
They call it the most precise iPad stylus money can buy. So they also agree. This is that they like the Adonit, the Jot Pro. Andy Anatko is at the Chicago Sun-Times. You can catch his new review of iPhoto there in the printed newspaper as well as online.
In print as well as online.
Yes,
we are multifaceted. Yes. We want your eyeballs. We don't care whether they're aimed at glass or dead trees.
He is an ink-stained wretch. He also blogs at www.cwob.com and lots of great pictures. And are you going to publish your sketches? I think that's kind of a neat idea.
I posted one or two of them. I'll probably, when I finally get around to actually hitting the button on all the Dublin stuff, I'll probably include them there too.
Cool.
My problem is that editing the photos takes, the photos are all edited, but I'm like, I want to have circles and arrows and a paragraph on the bottom of each one explaining what the scene is. And so it's like, that's why it takes me 5 months to publish anything.
You're just too good. We also want to thank Darren Okada for joining us from the ASC.com. He is a professional cinematographer.
Well, it's great to be here. Yeah. This is fun. In the brick house.
Maybe we could do a video of me as Harry Truman.
Absolutely.
What do you think? And the buck stops
holding up
here.
A newspaper. holding up a newspaper saying CNBC defeats Twit.
Yeah.
Thank you all for being here. We do Mac Break Weekly, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC on Tuesdays on twit.tv. It's fun if you can watch live. We really appreciate it. And as you can see, we pay attention to the chat room. It's very helpful. But if you can't, don't worry. We make video and audio versions of all our shows available after the fact on the website at twit.tv. Thank you for being here. And stay tuned if you're watching live. Twit Photos coming up next. Another Mac Break is broke.